Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM.
Hello and welcome to the Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM with John Dixon and myself, Ben Emmett. Good evening, John.
Good evening, Ben, and hi, everybody.
Hi, everyone. As ever, our email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie and the text and WhatsApp number is 087-179-1032. We'll get to, immediately. As usual, well, what to see in the sky over the coming week.
Yeah, what not to see is the International Space Station. Just at the moment, it went out of our evening skies a couple of nights ago, ending on September the 28th, and it's now the end of September. Tomorrow's October, where's the year gone indeed? Now, back in our skies, November the 13th until December the 2nd, if you want to just jot that down in a diary somewhere. And as the time comes, we'll tell you exactly what times to watch and see the International Space Station coming through our evening skies across Ireland anyway, and certainly it'll do the same across everywhere else as well. Mercury remains buried in the glow of sunset at the moment, so you're not going to see it. Venus rises just a half an hour before the very beginning of dawn, so watch it for this to come up a little left due of east. You need to be in a good spot for this with no trees in the, on the horizon or anything like that. So you want a real horizon, like sea or something like that. Mars, it's a weak magnitude, plus 1.6. It's in Virgo at the moment. It's slipping away very low in the west-northwest as twilight fades. And you could try for it if you want to with a pair of binoculars about 30 minutes after sunset. And we want to wish you good luck in that one just in case. And if you do see it, let us know. Mars is very slowly nearing the end of its long 24-25 apparition, and it won't actually reach conjunction with the Sun until the start of 2026. Jupiter, on the other hand, magnitude minus 2.1. Now, I watched this over the last couple of evenings because it has been fairly clear at 3:30 in the morning. Yeah, it's a great time to watch it because it's up fairly high and it's good and dark up there at the moment. So it rises around midnight or just 1 a.m. depending where you are. Daylight saving time and dominates the east in the morning hours advance, which will be, we're falling back at the end of October. We have to remember that as well, so we better be careful as to who, why, where, what and where and all the planets are around. Saturn was at opposition on September the 2nd. It now rises just before sunset and glows in the east, southeast as the stars come out. At magnitude plus 0.7, it's quite dim at the moment. It's brighter, of course, than some of the stars of the Great Square of Pegasus, which stands out on one corner to Saturn's upper left. If you want to get a better understanding of this, I think Google World or the internet of some sort will help you, guide you through the sky, or get one of these apps that shows you where everything is. You just point your phone at it and it'll, although I do find them slightly off. I don't know whether you do with yours.
Yes.
They're fractionally off, but still they're pretty accurate. I'm sure there's probably something that we've done or haven't done to the app for that. Now the other two, Uranus and Neptune. Uranus 5.6. It's in Taurus near the Pleiades at the moment. It rises around 9 p.m. It's high before midnight, which is a great time to see it, which because it's nice and dark. And you need a high-power telescope. It's tiny, but definitely a non-stellar dot at 3.6 arcseconds wide. And when we say non-stellar, it doesn't flicker. Well, it will flicker, I think, a little bit. But
well, I think what's meant by that is it's not a pinpoint of light. You can just about see it as a disc.
Yeah. And Neptune, the last one, telescopic star, magnitude 7.8. It's dimmer again, and it's just 2.4 arcseconds wide as well. So that's what's happening. Not a lot, unfortunately. Jupiter really is the one to see, and when they stand beside Castor and Pollux in Gemini, it has been a beautiful sight on the last couple of nights for me anyway.
I did see them last Wednesday morning just after dawn, or round about dawn, or maybe round about there, before or after.
What are you doing after dawn?
I have to get up and go to work.
I raid the fridge at 3:30 in the morning.
Gotta be careful.
Nip out and have a look, yeah.
Anyway, yes, Venus unmistakably bright in the east, and Jupiter almost overhead, quite near up where, near, I think, Deneb. Deneb is almost overhead, but Jupiter's not far from it. Mm. And I hadn't seen Jupiter in a long time, so I did take out my little app phone, and the app I use is Sky Map. And it is a little off, but there's no kind of mistaking it. Because you know, well, because it's so bright, you know it's a planet. And also, then when you use the app, you say, oh yeah, right above there, that has to be Jupiter. I have a good pointer for you on next Sunday evening. That's Sunday the 5th of October already. Can you believe it?
I can.
A little pointer for Saturn. Saturn, that's the bright object, about 4.25 degrees to the lower left of the moon. So Sunday evening, check the moon, and 4.25 degrees to the lower left of that, 4.5 degrees is about the width of a fingertip or two at arm's length. Oh, on Thursday the 2nd, Venus is at perihelion, which is its nearest, basically its closest approach to the sun. It's like most of the planets, the orbits are not perfectly circular. They are off a little bit. So, and it will be at 0.718 astronomical units, or AU, one astronomical unit, to be in the mean distance between the Earth and the sun. Oh, Saturday the 4th begins. Oh, it's International Observe the Moon Day, and Space Week begins. And that runs, naturally enough, until the 12th. So we'll have some more information on that next week. Not much on it at the moment. Let me just tell you a little bit about the moon. We have a 58% waxing gibbous moon. It is currently above our horizon. In fact, the first quarter was 1 o'clock this morning, which, of course, by definition means it was a 50% phase, but now we're already up to 58%. And when it sets tonight at 11:18 p.m. here in Dublin, it'll be up to a 60% waxing gibbous phase. And when it rises tomorrow morning, or rather tomorrow afternoon, at round about 5:20, depending on where you are, it will be a 62% phase as we head towards the full harvest moon next Tuesday morning. And just to remind you about the sun, who can miss it? We missed it recently, although it was up and about. Was it up and about today?
It was for a little
bit. Did you see it?
I did, yeah.
I was locked away all day. Anyway, tomorrow, Wednesday, the 1st of October, it will rise in Dublin at 7:26 a.m, 12 minutes later than a week ago. Local noon, that's when it's due south, and at its highest, that's at 1:14 p.m. And the sun sets, would you believe it, at 7:01 tomorrow evening, which is 17 minutes earlier than a week ago. And then we have various shades of twilight until just before 9 p.m. when astronomical twilight ends and midnight, or not midnight, but astronomical night officially begins. So 29 minutes less daylight than a week ago is what we'll have tomorrow, when there'll be another 4 minutes and 10 seconds shaved off that. 4 minutes and 10 seconds less daylight than today. So there'll be 11 hours and 34 minutes between sunrise and sunset.
I'm starting to notice that, certainly early in the morning when it's time to get up for work and stuff. So it's pretty dark in the mornings now. Suddenly, over the last couple of weeks, it's gone that way, and getting dark earlier in the evening as well. It's about after 8, it's starting to get a little bit mushy or dark, or whatever you want to call it. And of course, at the end of the month, we lose an hour again. And then we're back in the winter months. Now, why do moons or full moons have names? So, many full moon names date back to the Native Americans, who lived in what is now the northern and eastern United States. They kept track of the seasons by giving distinctive names to each recurring full moon. and that is how they kept track of time. They didn't only name the full moon, but the month was also called after the name as well. So there's a lot of reading in this, but so you can Google this and why and who and where and what and when they're all called for. So just take May's flower moon. It's called after the flowers, which are abundant everywhere in May. It was also known as the full corn planting moon or the milk moon. So they have all sorts of different names as well. So an interesting read if you just Google why the moon has many names, why the full moons have names. So it's quite an interesting topic to do, because we often know that there are names, but we don't know why they were called those.
Thank you, John. And thanks to Aaron for your text. I think Aaron is in Tala, if I'm not mistaken. He has written in to us many times before. And we're talking about time going fast. Mm-hmm. And he says, yeah, it does seem to go faster every year, especially when you get a bit older.
Yep, as the years get on, they get faster and faster.
Yeah, and last week we had Sean O'Carroll, mm-hmm. the filmmaker, in with us, not in with us, rather, but we were speaking to him on the phone about his new documentary. It's 1 hour long. As I mentioned last week, he was giving I think it was the first showing of it. There was an IAS meeting over in UCD, and they showed the film, and had very good. It's about the people, the Irish people behind astronomy, with the passion for astronomy. And some of the usual kind of well-known names, I suppose, and some not so well-known, some professional astronomers, some mostly amateur astronomers who have the passion, and about basically what the one thing about astronomy is that anyone can, you don't need to be super genius. You just need to look up mm. and appreciate, and mostly when you do look up, you do appreciate what you see and the benefits. They were talking about dark skies and how light pollution, well, that's a whole new, it's a different story entirely, but how light pollution is affecting our view of the night sky. But basically about the essentially practically infinite variety of things to view and to learn about the universe. But not on a sadder note, but on a not so positive note, there are some what they call invisible asteroids near Venus. And there's a team of astronomers saying that they may pose a long-term danger to the Earth, that they are effectively hidden from view. They share Venus' orbit, and they are extremely difficult to observe because of their position in the sky relative to the sun. So there's a big study and data modelling and long-term simulations, and these what they call Venusian co-orbital asteroids can shift between orbital configurations every 12,000 years or so on average, and during these transitions they may come close enough to Earth to cross its orbit, which of course increases the risk of an impact. Now, only 20 such of these objects have been catalogued to date. They are quite eccentric in their orbit, which makes them easier to detect. But some of the researchers believe that there are more with this lower eccentricities in their orbit that keep them very near the sun. And according to their computer modelings, this would suggest that they could approach Earth so closely that eventually impacts become statistically unavoidable over the next couple of thousand years or so. And they're saying that an asteroid about 300 metres in diameter, which would create a crater, would form a crater 3 to 4 kilometres wide, could release enough, or the energy equivalent to hundreds of megatons. And they may be hidden out there, and of course, the equivalent of a 100 megaton explosion near any city or populated area would be, of course, devastating. And so they're looking, using telescopes like the new Vera Rubin Observatory in Chile. They can see them usually for only brief moments of time. Sometimes they can see them for a week or two, and then they seem to disappear for years, months or years. But that's, of course, because of their orbits and because they're so close to the sun, very hard to detect. So more study needs to be done, and it is thought that some of these bodies originated in the main asteroid belt and were later basically nudged inwards by some gravitational interactions and then temporarily captured into Venus's orbit, but the orbits are unstable, and that means that they may evolve into Earth crossing paths or be expelled from the solar system over time, which of course would be better than slamming into the Earth.
Yeah, and I found an asteroid crater just today, actually, and I didn't know about this particular one. It's called Lake Bosum Twi, or Bosum Twi. I'm not sure how to pronounce that one. It's the only natural lake in Ghana, in Africa. It's situated within the ancient impact crater. That is about 10.5 kilometers in diameter. It's about 30 kilometers southeast of a place called Kumasi, which is the capital of Ashanti, and it's a popular recreation area. It's about 30 villages who live near the crater lake, and a combined population of about 70,000 people. It's really weird, isn't it, that was hit, I suppose. They reckon about a 10.5 kilometer in diameter asteroid. And there's a lot of water in this now. It's just filled up, so you wouldn't really know it as an asteroid impact crater, because we have the one, of course, in Arizona, which was completely dry, and it was only hit by something, 100 meters wide, something like that. It's not quite as big as this one. This is a monster. The depth of the crater is approximately 380 meters, and if counted together with the depth of lake sediments, it has a depth of 750 meters. So there was a big, bang, and then as the water came in, it dragged sediment back down to make it a little bit shallower. But it's partly eroded at this stage, situated at a dense rainforest, making it difficult to study, and confirms its origin by this meteorite impact. And you can see, if you look at the photograph of Lake Bosum Twi, that's the way I'm going to pronounce it. And they reckon it's about 1.07 million years old. It's rainfall inflows into it. And maximum length, 8.6 kilometers. Maximum width, 8.1. That's a monster.
That's a big one. What about the crater? Have you heard about Silver Pit Crater?
Yes.
That's the one in the North Sea. Now, we have mentioned this one before. I think it was a couple of years ago. But apparently some new research has confirmed that this crater, Silver Pit Crater, which is 700 meters or so below the North Sea, that it was created by a hypervelocity impact about 43 to 46 million years ago. Now, there was a team studying this some years and years ago, and somebody decided, it wasn't a crater caused by an impact, but a basically collapsed volcano. But new research and study seems to have put that theory to bed. And this particular crater was only discovered in 2002. It's 3 kilometers wide and encircled by a 20-kilometer fault zone. And as I mentioned, 700 meters beneath the sea, about 80 miles off the Yorkshire coast.
Could you imagine the splash of that?
Well, they reckon it caused a tsunami over 100 meters high, so you wouldn't want to be within 1,000 miles of that, I'd say, anywhere on low-lying land. And so they basically went back and looked at the data again, and as one person said, I always thought that the impact hypothesis was the simplest explanation, and now they're delighted that they have found evidence to prove that it's not a collapsed volcano.
Now, they're all over our little planet, all these big...
Have you ever seen, if you look at a map of Canada, have you ever seen that? It's here in Quebec province, and there's you can see there's lots of lakes up there, but there's one that's like a donut. You see this very... almost perfectly circular water feature. I think there's a river running in and out of it, and it's almost perfectly circular that you look at it and say, well, that doesn't look natural, and that one's huge. I can't remember off the top of my head how big it is, but you can see that that's been shown again to be caused by an impact from a meteorite. So, there's been many more in the past,
and no doubt
there will be. Well, they're saying it's statistically it's a certainty they're over at least, maybe, you could be talking about a couple of 100,000 years that there will be in another big one. Maybe a million years, but we won't be here in a million years.
No, we
certainly. And I don't just mean you and I.
Yeah. Yep. And they reckon one hits every sort of 100 years, a really good one, like the Tunguska. That's the one up in Siberia.
I wouldn't say a good one.
Wiped out a million trees, even that particular one. Came in at a particularly low angle, didn't hit directly. I'm not sure if it just broke up or did it just skim the surface and go back out again. We're just not sure on that one. Do you remember back in August the 20th, Noah's Ark went up with 75 mice and 1,500 flies to do a little bit of experimentation.
Oh, the fruit flies.
Yeah. And they came back from outer space just a few days, September the 19th, in fact, in the steppes of the Orenburg region after spending 30 days in Earth's orbit. And they did a bit of experimentation. After launch, the craft was placed into polar orbit, which is an unusual type of an orbit, about 230 to 236 miles in altitude at an inclination of about 97 degrees. So polar orbits they're getting more popular now, but they're certainly not as popular as it used to. So we have photographs taken from the recovered craft here suggesting that the landing spurred a small brush fire. I wonder how that happened. Fires apparently extinguished quite quickly. I did see the pictures of this actually, and there was a fire in the background, allowing recovery crews to approach the descent module. And it doesn't say whether everything survived it or not, but no doubt we'll hear over the next little while as to what experiments they were at and how they went, etc. like that. So they had 75 mice, 1,000 fruit flies, and came back on September the 19th. I meant to say that last week, but we just didn't have time because we were talking to somebody else on the phone.
Indeed we were. Now, when we go back to the moon, of course, the plan is for long-term habitation on the moon, and for that you need to have a little house or such like to build in. You can't just land on, if you remember the Apollo era, where the most anyone stayed, I think the longest mission, on Apollo 17, that they might have spent a few days there on the moon, 4 or 5. But anyway, the plan is to build settlements there. But I see the China's Deep Space Exploration Laboratory, or DSEL, they have produced and presented a prototype machine capable of transforming lunar soil into construction bricks. It's solar powered, and the system is the first proof of concept design device designed to fabricate building materials directly on the moon. Now, it's a machine that concentrates sunlight using a parabolic reflector, transmits the energy through a fiber optic bundle, and at the output end, the solar flux can reach over 3,000 times normal intensity, which they say produces a temperature above 1,300 degrees Celsius, and basically that these conditions allow the lunar regolith, or soil or sand or grit or whatever you want to call it, to melt and be moulded into solid bricks suitable for roads and structures.
Yeah.
Imagine roads and houses built out of built out of sand. Well, this is essentially what we do here, but it's a different type of structure. So they have used several different types of mixtures of the regolith, because it's not all quite the same, although I think it's a lot of it is a lot of calcium and silicates in it, but the exact composition from one end of the moon to the other is not exactly the same. So they've tried various combinations, and they believe they can make bricks that on the lunar surface. And I mean, that's because we can't bring them there. Well, you could bring them there, but you'd need, it would cost too many rockets and the cost of launching a few tons of bricks up, and which wouldn't get you too far. It would be just
millions
of billions just to build one house. So you think the price of houses here are bad? If you were to transport bricks to the moon, that would be an expensive house.
Certainly would. Would the realtors or the estate agents be able to afford to live up there? I don't know. You need a pot of money for that one. I wonder if you get any rainbows, you could start digging. They also say that you can...
Want to think about that one, John, about rainbows on the moon.
Yeah.
What causes rainbows?
Well, this is a new thing, you see. If they have water up there making this, they can generate.
Yeah, I suppose.
Yeah, they reckon that they can collect water from inside the permanent frosty sort of edges of craters and things up there as well. So there's a little bit of water, as they call it water. What type of water it is, we just don't know, but they reckon they could work with it. Now, the travel to Mars, this is one of the big things that's been going on for the last, oh, goodness knows how long. How are we going to get there? So they reckon now, with the experiments they're doing, could astronauts travel to Mars on nuclear-powered rockets? These scientists want to make it happen, and they're designing something at the moment for a nuclear-powered rocket that could be the key to making the solar system more accessible. They need to talk to Captain Kirk on this one. Warp factor 7. That's really all they can get to on that one. That's 7 times the speed of light. That was quick. Mm-hmm. And that was way back in the 60s.
Yes, well, even if we could go to seven times the speed of light, mm-hmm. that would take, how long would it take to get to Alpha Centauri there, which is about 6 months.
Yep.
To the nearest star.
Yep, an awful long time.
That's assuming an average speed, that if you could, well, if you have to take into acceleration and deceleration, that's another thing. But anyway, that's all fantasy at this moment.
Anyway, they reckon that the space missions in the future could travel to Mars using nuclear-powered craft. They haven't really spoken about that. I haven't heard them speaking about nuclear-powered. Because once you get up there and you're at a certain speed, you can just shut the engines off and you keep going. So, of course, we have nuclear-powered craft on the Voyager, guys. So Voyager 1 and Voyager 2. And they were only tiny little nuclear-powered power plants, and they're still working so many years later.
Yeah, well, of course, they weren't used for propulsion. They were used to provide energy to run the instrumentation and send the signals back to Earth, because it's just because it was going to go so far from the sun that there was solar panels that were going to be of no use. A little closer to the sun, of course, is Venus. And you were mentioning water, and I see now that a new analysis of the aerosols in Venus's clouds, and it was data going back from 1978 that was re-examined, and a series of astronomers have discovered and claimed, with lots of evidence, that there's a lot more water and iron in the clouds of Venus. Now, they're saying that Venus's cloud aerosols contain iron sulfides and sulfuric acid in considerable masses, about 20% each, I think, and 3 times the abundance of water, about 60%. And this is a big kind of update or revision of the amount of water that we thought was in the clouds of Venus. I think not the odd thing about that, but I suppose the interesting thing about that is that the data has already been there, collected by the Pioneer spacecraft, I think, the Mariner went to Mercury. But looking at data from years and years ago, and you put it together and say, hold on a second, the data suggests that, and they used some of the Russian data as well, the Vega probes that landed there and went through the atmosphere and picked up some particles, and they had, of course, a mass spectrometer on board. So when you review the data, you can come up with what you thought. Well, this is a different result, and you can make astounding new discoveries even with older data.
Anyway, just before we go, Ben, happy Astronomy Day, which was on the 27th. This is Astronomy Day 2025. It's upon us now, and it's gone. And it was an American Astronomical League of enthusiasts and experts bring up the stargazing event. So it's quite fun to do all this. And it's, I suppose, to get people more out to look up and get the telescopes, binoculars out to see what's up there in the skies, because still a lot of people are not terribly interested in stars and things like that. And it's a once-a-year thing, so it's in around the 27th of September, and you can start, I suppose, by looking at the moon, and you can follow it by Saturn, and just pick a few things in the sky and just see if you can see them. The Andromeda Galaxy is another one to look at. That's easy to spot at the moment, although you get a creak in your neck looking at it at midnight because it's straight above our heads, but it's in absolutely black skies. And it's a wonderful thing to see, because I know exactly where it is. And although we can't see it terribly well with the naked eye, with a pair of binoculars you can, or a telescope. Anyway, that's about it.
Thank you for that. Now time to go talking about the white dwarf star that's slowly munching away on a planet, destroying it. It's the planet is the size of Pluto, but perhaps
Pluto,
we'll get...
Yes.
Well, I'm sorry I mentioned Pluto now. Mm-hmm. Maybe we'll get to that next week. Thank you, John. But that's all from us here in the Astronomy Show. And... it's music all the way now until 2 a.m. here on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Up next is Dublin's Greatest Hits from 10 p.m. to midnight, Nigel Wood, and from midnight till 2 a.m. Dave Barry. This program's called After Hours, and it's a mix of jazz, blues, soul, and lots more besides. But please join myself and John at the same time, 7:30 p.m. next week. We'll be back with all the latest news from all corners and dimensions of the universe. Until then, take care of each other. Thank you for listening, and say good night, John.
Good night, John.
Good night, John.
Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM.